Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on our show, we look at how a former American president has spent his time over the more than 30 years since he left office. Last week, Jimmy Carter turned 90. As we will learn, he has not slowed down much at all, and he loves the life he leads.
It's been a very exciting and challenging and unpredictable and adventurous, and I would say a very gratifying life.
The active life of a former American president, today on As It Is. Former President Jimmy Carter recently celebrated his 90th birthday. Mr. Carter served in the nation's highest office between 1977 and 1981. He has lived more years after leaving the White House than any former president. Today, he leads an active life as the head of the Carter Center with his wife, Rosalyn. They have been married for 68 years. VOA recently spoke with the Carters and with Walter Mondale, who served as Mr. Carter's vice president.
But he's got this part of him, this focus, this commitment. He gets on to something, he wants to get it done.
Mr. Carter is known as one of the most busy and successful former presidents. But his wife is not happy to hear people talk only about what her husband has done since leaving the White House.
Yeah, and I don't like that. He was a great president. People are finding it out. And I like them to say, well, he's the greatest ex-president. Well, he is the greatest ex-president, but he was a great president, too.
My name is Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president.
Mr. Carter served 4 years as president. During his term, he officially established normal relations with China. He returned the U.S.-controlled Panama Canal to Panama. And he negotiated a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. But his successes are balanced by failures, including America's economic problems in the late 1970s and the Iran hostage crisis. Joe Crespino teaches at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He does not agree with Rosalyn Carter that her husband was a great president. But the history professor also does not blame Mr. Carter for many of the problems he faced during his 4 years in the White House.
I think it's clear that his presidency was not the greatest. That's not all of his doing. That's not all of his fault. A lot of that had to do with the circumstances he inherited. But I don't think there's shame in being called the greatest ex-president.
In November 1980, President Carter was defeated for re-election. Former California Governor Ronald Reagan became president. Mr. Carter chose to return to the small town of Plains, Georgia, where he had grown up. It is also the place where he will be buried. After presidents leave the White House, they create a library and museum where people can learn about their presidency. But Mr. Carter wanted to build something other than a traditional presidential library filled with official documents. He wanted to create a place where conflicts could be resolved, as he had done when he persuaded the leaders of Egypt and Israel to end their disputes. So he created the Carter Center, a non-profit organization. The center, in its words, wages peace, fights disease, and builds hope throughout the world. Mr. Carter told VOA the organization has been a success.
But it's grown enormously, and one of our basic principles has been that we don't duplicate what other people are doing. And so we have filled vacuums in the world, you might say, and over a period of 30 years or more now, we've gone into areas of international politics and alleviation of suffering and promoting democracy that others had never done.
Workers at the Carter Center have watched more than 90 troubled elections throughout the world as a way to make sure voters are heard. The Carter Center has also joined the fight against tropical diseases in many Latin American and African countries. And the center is working to end the threat from Guinea worm disease. If successful, it will be only the second time a disease has been stopped. In the 1970s, health workers eliminated smallpox. Because of his efforts around the world, many people look at Jimmy Carter as a trusted statesman and valued negotiator. But not everyone would agree. Professor Joe Crespino notes that some world leaders and rights activists are not happy that Mr. Carter is willing to meet with almost anyone, no matter how corrupt or abusive.
He's been criticized for talking to leaders around the world, that he'll go and talk to anyone. And he's always criticized for that. He always feels like the fundamental issue for him is to try to bring people together and have conversations about difficult problems.
Mr. Carter is unhappy with the unwillingness of the United States government to open direct talks with North Korea. The former president has made several visits to the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. And he says he is willing to go there again as a representative of the U.S. government to negotiate the release of three Americans held there. But he told reporters he has yet to receive permission from the Obama administration for such a trip.
But there's no need for me to go unless I can get a designation from the U.S. government that I'm speaking officially for the U.S. government, which I cannot do. That's the truth of the matter.
While he waits for permission to go to North Korea, Mr. Carter continues working in other places where he sees a need that other countries and organizations have not met. It is what keeps him active, even at the age of 90.
And it's been a very exciting and challenging and unpredictable and adventurous, and I would say a very gratifying life.
Plan of action made a lot of sense. He talked about the government and how it used to be for you and me. That's the way it ought to be. Right now, once and for all, why not?
That's our program for today. I'm Christopher Cruz. Join Jim Tedder tomorrow at this same time for another As It Is program here on The Voice of America.
I was listening to quite a man talking to me. I began to see. We need Jimmy Carter. Why settle for less, America? Once and for all, why not the best? We need Jimmy Carter. We can't afford to settle for less. America. Once and for all, why not the best? Why not the best? Why not the best?
The Technology Report is next, followed by This is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Facebook and other social media sites are free for everyone. But a new social media site promises to be more exclusive by only permitting people who are rich to join. The site is called Netropolitan. To join, users must pay $9,000. This includes a $6,000 entry fee plus $3,000 for the yearly membership fee. James Tushy Peters is the founder of Netropolitan. He is a composer and orchestra conductor from the Eastern American state of New York. He says he believes there is a need and an audience for this service. He says he had trouble finding people like him on other social sites. He says Netropolitan is a place where rich people can talk about what he calls the finer things in life. In his words, Netropolitan is an online country club focused on connecting members around the world. He says it is for people with more money than time. Unlike Facebook, everything on Netropolitan is private. The site is not included or indexed by search engines like Google or Bing. Non-members can only see the login screen when they visit the site. Information to and from the site is hidden or encrypted. This gives the site's members even more privacy. Netropolitan does not have any advertising, and it will employ monitors to prevent bad behavior. Members must be 21 or older, and they must use their real names and addresses to register. Once they have registered, members can do things like create groups and join discussions on the site. Mr. Tushy Peters has not said how big he hopes the site's membership will grow, and he has not said how many members the site has. He does say it has a small group of pre-qualified members. The website says it will never publicly state the exact number of members in the club. And especially, we will never release or verify the identity of any of our members. Ever. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at VOA Learn English. I'm Jonathan Evans.
from VOA Learning English. Welcome to This is America. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. About 3.7 million Chinese Americans live in the United States. A 2009 study showed the American public considered Chinese Americans educated, hardworking, and having strong family values.
Chinese Americans have not always been accepted easily into American society. The first large group of Chinese immigrants came to the United States in the middle 1800s. At that time, some Chinese moved to the American West to build a railroad across the country. Many others worked in mines or on farms. Chinese immigrants helped the U.S. economy. However, most Americans saw the Chinese as competitors.
William Wei teaches history at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He says Chinese immigrants were not treated well. They had to live together in poor neighborhoods or do hard work in laundries and restaurants that did not pay very much. Mr. Wei says the American public did not believe Chinese immigrants could ever be part of their society. In fact, in 1882, the U.S. Congress approved and the president signed the Chinese Exclusion Act. The law barred Chinese people from moving to the United States and becoming citizens. It was the first and only U.S. law to ban a specific ethnic group. The U.S. government canceled the ban during the 1940s after China became an American ally in World War II. Yet the government limited the number of Chinese migrants to just 105 per year. Finally, in 1965, the government ended the system restricting Chinese immigration.
Frank H. Wu leads the Hastings College of the Law at the University of California. He says the history of Chinese immigrants in the United States helps explain why so many Chinese Americans are well-educated. The Chinese people who were able to immigrate were talented. They were students on scholarships. They were people who had great potential, he says. Mr. Wu says many Chinese Americans are pleased the American public considers them smart, good citizens who fit well into the country. But, he adds, even positive stereotypes about Chinese Americans cause problems. Imagine someone standing up and saying, "My race is better. You should be like me," he says. Mr. Wu says the United States includes people of many races, and one race should not be considered better. He says white Americans may also blame other minorities for not being as successful as the Chinese. Some Americans say, "Look what we did to the Chinese. We discriminated against them, committed violence against them, excluded them from our country. Yet they still have achieved. Therefore, if your minority has not succeeded in our land of opportunity, it is clearly your fault." Mr. Wu says such thinking leads people to think victims are responsible for their abuse. Charles Gallagher of LaSalle University added that all Chinese Americans are not good in school. One who does not succeed as easily may feel he or she does not really belong.
Helen Zia is a Chinese American writer. She says U.S. policymakers may believe the Chinese are successful, so the government does not have to help those who are poor or suffering. And, Ms. Zia says, some people may believe Chinese Americans are too successful. If we are perceived as being able to endure everything, it also means that we can be perceived as being able to take over everything, she says.
Frank H. Wu is the son of parents who immigrated to the United States from China. Mr. Wu says people ask him every day where he is from. I explain that I'm from Detroit, Michigan, he says. Detroit is a city in the middle of the U.S. But people shake their heads and say, no, no, what I mean is, where are you really from? Frank Wu says the word really shows he is not considered a true American. He says the question can make him and other Chinese Americans feel hurt. Mr. Wu writes about Asian American issues for the Huffington Post website. He notes that some Americans say they do not trust Chinese Americans. They are called communists, he says, with secret loyalties to China. A 2012 survey of U.S. public opinion found some truth in Mr. Wu's observation. The survey showed that about one-fourth of those questioned believed Chinese Americans would support China over the United States in a dispute between the countries. Another survey found that 72% of Chinese Americans said discrimination against their community was a problem.
Chinese American writer Helen Zia once said, whenever U.S.-China relations get chilly, Chinese Americans get pneumonia. In other words, political problems between the two countries affect Chinese Americans personally. Trade between China and the United States is one example. Some American industries say Chinese businesses import products at prices that are too low. The prices are not fair, they say. And, as a result, American companies must cut workers. Helen Zia says, such complaints are like thinking of Chinese imports as evil.
Ms. Zia says the American public also criticizes U.S. politicians for developing close relationships with China. For example, in 2012, critics of President Barack Obama said he had violated election laws by accepting cash donations from China. The Obama campaign denied violating such laws. Ms. Zia said U.S. politicians accuse each other of being corrupted by Chinese money. She said that is another way of playing to the public's fear of any Chinese invasion of the United States.
In 2009, a Chinese-American group called the Committee of 100 asked the American public for their opinion about Chinese Americans. About 80% said they had a good or positive attitude about Chinese Americans. But only 64% of Chinese Americans said they felt others had a positive attitude toward them. Sociology professor Charles Gallagher says most Americans believe they are accepting of minorities. But, he says, Americans can accidentally cause harm if they act like everyone in a minority group is the same.
Bernie Wong leads a Chinese-American organization in Chicago. She says attitudes about her community have improved. In the past, she says, Americans believed people from China worked only in stores and restaurants. Now there are many Chinese Americans who are in the corporate world and very successful in investing in new businesses, she says. So the whole attitude has shifted. Bernie Wong adds that the Chicago government now asks Chinese Americans for their opinions about political and business concerns. And when Chinese Americans say they have been treated unfairly, she says, her organization works with city officials to resolve the problem. We don't always assume that people look at us negatively, Ms. Wong said.
In September 2014, the Pew Research Center published information about international migrants. The United Nations defines an international migrant as a person who has been living for a year or longer in a country other than the one in which he or she was born. The Pew Research Center found that over 45 million international migrants lived in the United States in 2013. Yet Pew found only 850,000 people living in China were born in other countries. Let us put that another way. Last year, about one in every seven U.S. residents came from another country. But you would have had to meet about 1,600 people in China before you met a foreigner who was a permanent legal resident. The comparison between the two countries is interesting because the United States and China have the biggest economies in the world. But China has over 1 billion more people. David Fitzgerald is with the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at the University of California in San Diego. He explained that both the U.S. and China are unusual when it comes to immigration.
So what makes the U.S. unusual is this sustained volume of immigrants. The U.S. has been a major country of immigration since its founding.
In other words, many immigrants have come to the U.S. for many years. In the beginning, Mr. Fitzgerald says, the main reason was space.
The U.S. had a very small population on a very big continent and was very keen to attract foreigners to populate that continent.
By comparison, Mr. Fitzgerald said, moving permanently to China is more structured, and the country does not have a history of immigration. Instead, it has a history of emigration, of citizens leaving the country to live somewhere else. China's large population means that it does not need to employ many foreign workers with basic skills. Instead, China's international migrants are often well-educated professionals. Yet the low percentage of international migrants in China does not mean people are not moving.
There are actually more internal migrants within China moving from the countryside to the cities than there are total international migrants in the world.
Mr. Fitzgerald called the movement of people within China the largest migratory movement in world history. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly. You can read and listen to our programs at learningenglish.voanews.com. Join us again next week for This is America.